Hello and welcome to a special edition of Money Matters. I'm Dave Pezzo, of course, and I'm here. We're going to start off. It's going to be our political theater. We'll see how it goes. This should be fun. Congressman Russ Fulcher will be in a little bit later, and right now I'm with Senator Jim Risch, who was kind enough to give us some time today. So thank you, Senator, for coming in.
Well, Dave, thank you. The guy who should be sitting here is my partner, Mike Crapo. As you know, he's the ranking member on the Finance Committee, number two on the Banking Committee, has an incredibly powerful portfolio. I'm in a different lane, of course. Energy, Natural Resources, Foreign Relations, and Intelligence are mine. I'm the ranking member on the Foreign Relations Committee and number two on Intelligence and number two on Energy and Natural Resources. So we've between the two of us, we've cut a pretty wide swath. But the important thing is he and I always talk before a vote. As a result of that, we always vote together. I mean, I think all the years I've been there, we have voted differently two or three times or something like that. But it's important we don't offset each other for Idaho. Mm-hmm. We try to deliver two votes for Idaho. So, but Mike is the financial expert, and he's incredibly well dialed in with the people on Wall Street, the people who are in the banking community. And just the overall way that the government raises money, spends money, and that sort of thing. So I'm humbled to be here, but we'll call Mike if we get in trouble.
Okay. Well, as you know, so many of these things roll right into Wall Street. You bring up the foreign relations, and I've got a million things I want to talk to you about, but that one just jumps right out at me. If you want to pick on something that a lot of people, myself included, are concerned about is Taiwan.
Yeah,
and after what happened with Afghanistan, I can't imagine people like Putin and, of course, Xi to have to not be thinking it's a green light.
Yeah.
Are you concerned about that?
The other thing she's got to be looking at, too, is what happened in Hong Kong. I mean, they walked right into Hong Kong and paid no price for it.
Right.
I mean, and so here's Taiwan. And the fact of the matter is when you talk with the Chinese, they just reading between the lines, body language and everything else, they feel much stronger about Taiwan than they do about Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. You know, Hong Kong, they had a contract. The contract was up, blah, blah, blah. Taiwan forcibly extricated themselves from China. And, of course, the Chinese dispute that. They say they've never extricated themselves. They're part of China. They will always be part of China. And this isn't over until we fold them into the rest of China. So it isn't a question of if. It's a question of when they do it and how they do it. I contend that if it wasn't for the strait between them, the water between them, I think this would be over already if they could walk in. When you have that stretch of water, kinetic action is more likely the way they're going to do it as opposed to just kind of infiltrating. So we'll see how that works out. I was there in 1983 when there was absolutely no relationship between the two. In fact, we were in Taiwan to begin with. We went into China. We had to go to Hong Kong first and then go in because there were no commercial transactions. There were no air flights or anything. Now, of course, there's a tremendous amount of industry and business and commerce that flows back and forth, just like there is between the United States and China.
Yeah. So this is a rather big deal. You say not a question of if, but when. Obviously, most people feel that there is no chance of them just coming in and bombing the place. But at the same time, because they want the chip factories and all that stuff there. They want the technology. What do you see happening then? How do you see this happening?
Well, first of all, your comment about the chip factories is important for this reason. Anybody who's read China 2025, which is their vision for the future, realizes how deficient they are in the chip industry, which is really interesting because they're so dominant in many other fields, but they just haven't been able to get it right on chips. And so where is a chip manufacturer that they could get their hands on very quickly and ratchet up is obviously in Taiwan. So that makes it that makes it even a more lucrative and desirable target for them. How it happens, look, I don't know. You know, China is a big country, 1.5 billion people. It is run with an incredibly iron fist, and Xi can make the decisions he wants to make and go there. But look, they. In 1983, when I was in China, it was the first trip to China, I left there thinking, you know, we're never going to have to worry about this country. You know, they didn't have toilets. They didn't have toilet paper. They didn't have telephones. They had nothing. And I thought, 1.5 billion people, but they have nothing. Mm-hmm. My goodness, how they've moved in the last recent decades. And look, they did it the old-fashioned way. They stole every single idea we had, and mm-hmm. and it brought themselves to a very different position that they were. The only thing they didn't steal from us is our freedoms and our government and our democracy. But we have to deal with them. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with them. When 1.5 billion people, they're a nuclear power. They're a tremendous force in the economy of the world. We have to deal with them, but it's going to continue to be difficult. There's no question about that.
Yeah, yeah, it does seem to be very difficult. Yeah, no doubt. Now, there's so much talk right now about inflation, and it's real. We just got the numbers yesterday.
Biden says no.
Yeah, right. And Biden says we can spend more money will actually help inflation.
Dave, was there any? Does this come as a surprise to you after the federal government spends $5 trillion and puts that out into the economy, puts a system out there where people don't even have to work in order to just live, and it's phenomenal. And I think this inflation thing, what we're seeing right now, is just the beginning. I mean, the report we got yesterday, of course, I wasn't shocked by that. I doubt many people that deal in finance were shocked by that. It's going to be very hard to get this genie back in the bottle.
So what is the Fed, if you will, behind closed doors? What are they thinking? What is this administration think? We're going to somehow put this back in the bottle, but they not only haven't raised interest rates, which is fine, but they're still buying bonds. And we act like that the tapering means they're done. They're not done at all. They're still doing this. Yeah. Why?
Well, first of all, you say, what are they thinking, the administration and the Fed? Those are two very different heads.
Theoretically, they are.
I mean,
yeah.
But I think the administration is thinking, everything's going to be okay. This America, nothing can go wrong here. Yeah. I think that that's where they are. The Fed, on the other hand, not all of them, but the majority of them are clear-headed thinking people. I think that they have a good realization of what's going on here. It could be worse than what it is, I think. But they're going to have to continue to dial the switch back. There is no question about that. When you see like gas prices and home heating prices and those kinds of things are ratcheting up the way that they are. And a lot of this is anecdotal. It's starting to show up now objectively. But anecdotally, people will tell you, I can't talk to any manufacturer about the parts that they buy. They'll tell you startling stories. They'll say, start with, if you can get it, mm-hmm. it'll cost me 30% more, something like that. Well, there's got to be an inflationary spike that's a result of that. So I think that's coming. I think there's an inflationary spike coming.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
I believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's hard to get anything out there, including employees.
Yeah, especially employees. You know, for all the years I've been doing this, and it's been a long time, I always ask businesses when they come in, what's your biggest challenge? For years it was, the IRS, they're killing us, they're blah, 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 blah. Then it turned from there to regulations. Oh, regulations are murdering us, blah, 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 blah. So now, to an entity, I haven't had one entity answer this question differently, and that is, what's your biggest challenge? Can't find people to work. Mm. There's businesses right here in Boise that would love to be running three shifts and can only run one because they can't get people for the other two.
Yeah, exactly.
They say unemployment's what in Idaho, 2.4, 2.6. Who are these people? Because anybody who wants to work can get up in the morning and be on the job by noon. I mean, it's that simple.
It is that simple. In fact, you can, if you don't like your job, go get another one.
Well, there's a lot of that going on. You know,
there is.
A lot of that going on. And there's nothing wrong with that, mm-mm. with people shifting from going to a job they like better or do better or what have you. But if you're going to stay home and say, well, I'm just going to collect my unemployment that, as you know, when this whole thing started was at $900 a week, mm-hmm. And I'm going to wait for my next federal stimulus check, and I'm going to wait for my monthly check for the child tax credit, mm-hmm. But I'm not going to work, you know, you can understand it.
And I deserve it.
Yeah, and I deserve it, yeah.
I'm entitled.
Entitlement is a problem.
It is. All right, one more question before we end this segment here, too. Now, you voted for the infrastructure. You're a deficit hawk.
I am.
So, does that square for you or not?
Absolutely.
Okay.
First of all, I get the problem here. Let's take a second and ratchet back to November 3rd, 2020. After the election, the Democrats had the House. They had the White House. They tied in the Senate, but actually had it because they had the vice president to break any tie. They set out to change America. And those liberals back there, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC, the squad, they truly wanted to spend $10 trillion. Now, that's a pretty bold thing to do when you have an election like that. This was not, by any stretch of the imagination, an overwhelming mandate to them. People say all the time back there, I mean, trying to do what they're trying to do with that, with a tied Senate and three votes in the House, closest it's been since World War II, is nonsense. But anyway, they said, we want to spend $10 trillion to remake America in their socialistic image. And you know, all of us were sitting there thinking, this is a joke, right? I mean, $10 trillion is, it's incredible. So, As they went forward, it became obvious that even a number of members in their own party, Sinema and Manchin get all the ink, but I guarantee you there's a half a dozen others that because of the politics at home, they don't get up on the soapbox and beat their chest, but they are also reluctant to go down this road. In any event, it became obvious to them that things were going to have to get ratcheted back considerably. So they went along and got that down to about $6 trillion, and then decided, well, they... I mean, at $6 trillion, you're getting zero Republicans, okay? You can't do anything with zero Republicans. It can't be done. Mm-hmm. And so they kept the thing high-centered for them. They weren't getting anywhere. And so then what happened was this social bill that they were talking about, there were a number of Republicans who, we believe in infrastructure. If we're going to spend money, nothing wrong with infrastructure. I mean, we need infrastructure. And to be fair, we haven't spent as much on it as over the year, in recent years, as possible. So what they did is they split the infrastructure off. Now, who's they? They are a group of senators who got together from both sides of the aisle, said, we'd like to do this. Do not marry us to these social programs. We don't want anything to do with that. If you want to talk about infrastructure, let's do it. Okay. So Biden's bill. What they talked about, Biden's bill, splitting off, $2.5 trillion, massive tax increases. Zero Republicans were interested in that. We said, I'm out, everybody's out. But they negotiated in good faith. I was not part of that negotiating team. Mike Crapo was more of an advisor because he is so dialed into the financial aspects of this. So as they negotiated down, it high-centered pretty quickly. We weren't they weren't making any progress. Pretty soon they started to come around and they said, well, they got the number down from the 2.5 trillion. They knocked 80% of that off. Okay, so now you're down to $500 billion. And if you look at that over a 10-year period, you know, 50 billion on infrastructure, you know. So then they said, okay, what about all these tax increases? You know, tax increases are out. Okay, so now we're right back to where we've been for years, and that is everybody wants infrastructure. Nobody wants to pay for it. So where's this money going to come from? Somebody came up with a bright idea. I don't know who it was. I do know Crapo helped talk the Democrats into it. The $1.9 trillion that they spent in March, they appropriated it, they voted for it, it's on the books, it's going to be spent. They talked the Democrats into coughing up enough money to pay for the infrastructure bill so that there were, you know, there's no taxes. Money that was going to be spent on these social things. And so, I mean, all of a sudden, this became a no-brainer. Saving $2 trillion, no tax increases, and taking that social spending off the table. The problem is, it did then, And today it maintains the label of Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. This is not Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. Never has been, isn't even close to it, doesn't look anything like it. So,
gotcha. Anyway. Well, that's good. Thank you for that.
Sure.
All right, we've got to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got much more. Stay tuned. Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us. A special edition, of course, of Money Matters. I'm here with Senator Risch, and enjoying this conversation very much. That was very insightful.
Why is this a special edition?
Because this is going to be, I'm not here. We should do this more often, then it wouldn't be so special. That's right. We're not here just talking about the markets. But, you know, it is. Politics are important to the markets, at least in the long term. We take it short-term gyrations because of our, you know, we hate Obama or we hate Biden or we hate Trump. And so, therefore, you got to not invest or what have you.
Well, on top of that, politics controls who controls the government. And truly, those who want socialism for this country, their first target is the financial system.
Yeah.
Both the banking system and the financial markets. I mean, they would kill to get that if they could get nothing else, get their hands on those two, nationalize the banks and the same way with the financial markets. And,
absolutely.
And we know where that would lead.
So, you know, broadly speaking, as we talked earlier about inflation, in your mind, can the government do anything about that?
Well, the fiscal policy that the Fed puts in place has an impact on that, as does the spending by Congress. I mean, when you flood the market with money like Congress has done over the last months, that does, there's no question that, that affects inflation. And by the way, back up to when we started with the COVID thing, I got to tell you, for somebody like me that's conservative, and you're talking about spending that that amount of money that we were spending, we did that, and at the time I thought that was a good vote. As I sit here today and reflect on it, I don't think that was a good vote. I think that was a great vote. Mm-hmm. That was bipartisan. It was absolute unanimity amongst all senators and congressmen. Had we not done that and not done the things we did in there that included things like the Paycheck Protection Act and things like that, I'm convinced we'd be in the middle of a not a recession, but a depression right now. I mean, this was we were in uncharted waters. The world had never seen anything like this. We'd never seen anything like this. Back in 1929, they didn't have the kind of tools that, mm-hmm. that we have today to be able to do that. So I thought that was a great vote. We did a couple of follow-on ones that were smaller. Then we had an election come the March of 2021, and the Democrats passed that $1.9 trillion. At that point, by then, we were out. The markets were starting to recover. Mm-hmm. It was time for the marketplace to take back over again. The government need to do what they should do all of the time, and that is step back, take a breath, and stay out of this. But back to the beginning, we did the right thing there. I mean, the history of this will not be nearly as bad as it will be if we hadn't have done that.
Yeah, well, that's good. In hindsight, do you think we're going to look back and say this was a great decision to shut down the world, to walk over and flick the switch and over out?
I think the jury's still out on that. I've got a bill. Probably one of the most important things I'll do if I get this done, and I think I can, is I started when I was chairman of the committee before the elections. And then even after the elections, I continued on with it, and I got a bill out of the committee that is a global health bill. And what it does is it creates an entity to address a pandemic situation. WHO was supposed to do that, the World Health Organization. They fell on their face on this. And by the way, they if you sit down and talk with them, they admit that there were a bunch of mistakes made. They've done a great job on AIDS, on polio, on a number of other things. But they didn't have a fire department for something like this. When you have an emergency like this that is spreading like wildfire, WHO just isn't equipped to do that. So I've got some legislation in. It's going to create such an entity. Hopeful that when this happens again, and by the way, this is going to happen again, that we'd be ready for it. The ins and outs of how it's handled in each country, and indeed in each state, indeed in each community, I think the jury's still out on how that can and should be done. You can't, back there, my colleagues are always trying to pass a one-size-fits-all bill. Mm. It just doesn't work. Yeah. What works in Idaho does. The good example of that was the unemployment, where they added $600 a week. Mm-hmm. You know, that took it up to $900 for Idaho. Now, in New York, or if you live in New York or Los Angeles and you pay what you pay for the cost of living there, yeah, I get it. But not 77% that drew unemployment after that,
yep,
made more than they did when they were working on their job.
So why go back to work?
Well,
it was brilliant, I got to say, for our state, and I guess it was about 26 others to say no more.
Yeah, exactly.
It was
exactly.
Brilliant, and you can literally take the country and divide it in half.
And you
over
can color
who the
one
lowest,
red and one blue.
One red, one blue. And you will
exactly
simply
right.
say these all these reds have the low unemployment rate.
Yeah, that's right.
All the blues have the high.
That's exactly right.
And it's.
But yeah, and I mean, is this surprising? I mean,
you know, it shouldn't
there's
be.
There's a little common sense that comes into play here. You know,
yeah.
If you're making more at home and not working, why would you go back to work?
Exactly.
That makes sense.
So as you look at that, you know, you work all the time with Manchin. Mm-hmm. It seems odd as we look at this weird political theater, and you're right in it, but it looks weird to all of us out here. Just like it's like you look at people like Elizabeth Warren. What she got rich in doing nothing in her life, yeah, because she does stuff in a capitalist country and wants to completely destroy that. She can't be so dumb to say a good idea is to have all of the banking system that we have, the best in the world, the safest in the world. Torn down the way she talks about it. So what really are these folks trying to drive at?
Well, first of all, she isn't the only one. Bernie also has made a gazillion dollars.
You're right, doing nothing.
In the capitalist system.
Yeah.
You know, but in any event, look, people are different. I mean, we're ordinary people that serve back there. Any human being you took and put under the microscope, as you are when you're back there because you're taking positions on issues, would have issues from one side or the other, mm-hmm, arguing about it. So this, you know, it isn't surprising. They have a different view of things. They sincerely believe that a socialistic system where they can and the government can make decisions for you or I. Do you know why? They don't trust us to make decisions for ourselves. They really think that
they're better
at it. They're better at it, and they will always throw out anecdotal stories. Well, so and so did this. Hey, we're human beings. We're entitled to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
We are who we are. And they say, well, what does Idaho want? I say, this is real simple. Representing Idaho, they want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
They really want to be left alone, and they don't. They don't want some PhD in health sciences making a decision for them as to whether or not they should get vaccinated or not get vaccinated. Having said that, anybody who's listening out there, get vaccinated.
Yeah.
I don't think the government should tell you to get vaccinated, but please do. I mean, it's you know, I went through the polio thing when I was a kid. Most people listening weren't alive then, but this was. I mean, we struggled with polio, which was similar to this, where we had this. Every summer, we had this epidemic that would go through the country. And I remember my parents talking about Dr. Salk had invented this great vaccine. We all went to the school gymnasium, stood in line, and got a shot, or mm-hmm, most people got the sugar cube, and polio went away. Nobody stood up and said, well, Harry Truman says we should do this. Well, by golly, I don't like Truman. I'm not going to get the polio.
Yeah.
This everything in today seems to be tied to politics, you know, and tied to political personality.
You couldn't even imagine a virus becoming political, but it did.
It did. It really did.
We can't even make decisions.
Well, back there, I'm telling you, Dave, back there, and by the way, I'm not a great fan of the mask thing. Vaccinations, I'm all in 100%. But if you look at the science on the mask, in certain in hospitals, nursing homes, things like that, yeah. But generally, they don't help. Like the vaccine is the answer to the thing. But you go back to Washington, D.C., you can tell a Democrat and a Republican in Washington, D.C.
by wearing a mask.
I looked on the floor one time. We were having a big vote, and I looked on the floor. There was nobody on our side of the aisle. Everybody else on the other side of the aisle was wearing masks. So it's political. Why is this political?
I know.
This shouldn't be political, you know,
yep,
but it is.
It's absolutely true. All right. Let's go ahead and wrap this up here. Thank you so much for
Dave,
your time.
Really
I appreciate it. I look forward to...
We just scratched the surface here.
Oh, I know. We could go on for hours, yeah, but I appreciate your time.
Enjoy,
so thank you. Senator, thank you. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us. The special edition of Money Matters. Of course, I'm Dave Pezzo, and I'm joined by Senator Risch again for this segment. So thank you for sticking around. And Congressman Russ Fulcher, and first of all, you look great. Obviously, your treatments are, you're coming along.
Thank you.
Feeling better.
Feel really good right now. And so it's been a blessing. I don't recommend cancer for recreational purposes. So for whatever it's worth, if you have the option, stay the heck away from it.
Okay. That's
Dave, let me say,
good advice. Let me write that down.
Let me say the same thing you did. Russ looks good and obviously is feeling good. But I can't tell you how much Mike Crapo and I appreciate Russ joining us on the team. It's been great, and he's a great team player. We talk all the time and consult on issues, on bills, and everything else. And we've got a tight team, the four of us that represent Idaho there. And Russ has been just a superb addition to that team. And Russ, bless you, we're glad to have you.
That's a two-way street. You know, there's only four of us. And you compare that to like a California with 40-some members of the delegate, Texas, 30-some. And so we really need to stick together for the best interest of the state. And we do that. So right back at you, that's a two-way street.
It's awesome. I do know this as a fact, too. I haven't had to call your offices for help on anything, but I hear rave reviews from both of your offices. That hasn't always been the case. Certainly wasn't in I don't want to talk about it, but in some districts before, but I hear rave reviews about the help you guys give to Idaho.
One of the most important things we do is casework and helping Idahoans on particular issues that they have. Mm-hmm. And again, we work together on this and coordinate. In addition to that, I've got in my office, I've got the lowest turnover of anybody on Capitol Hill.
That's
535
awesome.
535 offices.
See, that always speaks to the top
of
the ladder.
That. But we think we've got some ways of doing this. And when Russ came in, he asked for our advice. So we were helpful, I think, Russ, in helping you get your office up and running. And with the experience we've had over the years doing it, and again, we all work together on that. So
outstanding. All right, let's start with this since you're both here for this segment. The election last week was, in our minds as amateurs on the sidelines, a big game changer. You've got the Dems that are fighting amongst themselves, and that's all good. So we don't have this horrendous mess going on as a bill. But then all of a sudden, you also have in the midst of that a pretty obvious outcome to this election. People don't like what's going on. It's not just Afghanistan. It's not just all this Build Back Better or socialism, whatever you want to call it. It was a big thrust back. Do you think that that this bill has really any legs left to it?
You're talking about the big bill.
Build Back Better.
Well, it passed the House on a completely partisan basis, and this is the socialization of America. But to the first part of your question, I sat with the Speaker of the House and her leadership immediately after this the vote in Virginia, and there was two impressions that came to me. One was arrogance. Two was being totally disconnected, because the Speaker and her leadership team basically just ignored it, just absolutely ignored it. And I think that to your earlier point, you can pick your problem going on in the U.S., but it's widespread, and it's whether it's border security or economy or homeland security or Chinese aggression or energy prices, inflation. People don't like what's going on. And so to heck with being a Republican or a Democrat, they just want to stand up for a change. And to see the House leadership just entirely ignore that and even come back and insinuate, well, we haven't socialized enough, we need to amp it up even more, that's arrogance and disconnection. And so that piece of junk bill is now transferred to the Senate. Jim, I hope you guys can kill it.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts here. First of all, interestingly enough, some of the socialists on our side have said privately that the more moderate Democrats, more clear-thinking Democrats saying, look, this ain't working. You know, that we're still a center-right country. America doesn't want where we're going. We need to ratchet back. The socialists are saying, no, this is our chance, once in a lifetime. Full, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And so you kind of sit there and listen to that. Anybody who didn't see this coming isn't very well tuned in. They, on our side, privately, the other side was wringing their hands over Virginia. And we got some breaks there, admittedly. I mean, the one break we got, I think, was a poster child. When in the debates, you recall the Democrats said, well, the parents shouldn't be telling schools what they should be teaching. What?
Yeah.
What? You know, we are the schools.
Yeah.
You know, it's not you, the elites. It's not the governments. We are this. And that, I think that really set the tone for that election. But look, the good news coming here is you don't know what's going to happen a year from now, because the midterms are a year from now. But the guys back there that crunch the numbers are looking at where the Congress is right now, where you have one party having both houses and the White House, and invariably that when that happens, the party in power loses seats. Well, and we're tied in the Senate to begin with. The House has only got three seats, so where are we? Well, they then equated that to what a president's fave unfave is, and as we all know, Biden's is at rock bottom. And if you take the correlation there, the change in seats in the House ought to be, Russell, you're going to smile at this, 57-seat flip. I told that to Kevin. I was at a lunch over there the other day. I told McCarthy that, and he said to me, you know, I only need 25. So anyway, I think this pendulum's going to swing back. And this is what happens when you have an election where people voted against somebody instead of voting for somebody that they wanted.
Right.
And they've got somebody now that they weren't particularly happy about, but the election turned on the negative vote.
Do you think this is going to get more people like Youngkin out? He's a good candidate. He's a smart guy coming in from the private sector. He's not, a politician with a lot of baggage coming in. This is a guy that came in. But he could debate. He was clear. He got Trump to stay away. And he did. Is Trump going to stay away? And are we going to have an attraction of, if you will, high-caliber candidates to say, I realize that I'm going to have my life ripped open and this is going to be terrible, but I'll run for office anyway?
Well, setting Trump aside, the question about getting your life ripped open, unfortunately, that's the world we live in today. I mean, it's a full-contact sport, and if you've got skeletons in your closet, they're going to get drug out in the street, and that's just the way it is. How this goes over for what Trump does, I can't answer that question. I don't think anybody can answer. I'm not sure he could answer the question if he was sitting here, but we'll see. He's I had a good friend of mine who's a Republican. He said, I'm a good strong Republican, but I don't particularly like Trump. But I said, well, there's, you know, people like that. And he says, I just wish you Republicans wouldn't just listen to him and him tell you what to do. And I says, listen, I have lunch every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday with all the other Republican senators. Donald Trump's name hasn't been mentioned in there in months. And he says, well, doesn't he call you guys and tell you what to do? And I said, no, that's not what's happening. You have to know these 50 senators to know how independent thinking we are. So, you know, we are where we are today. Where we're going to be in the future, you know, people speculate on it.
You know what, Dave, regardless of what Trump does in 24, he's going to be a factor.
Mm-hmm. Clearly,
in all of this.
How
big of that is yet to be seen. It sounds to me like he's preparing for it. I went to an event at Mar-a-Lago a few months ago, and it sounded like a campaign event to me. Don Jr. And his family are out and on the national media, and it just sounds like it to me. On your earlier question about are there going to be more Youngkins that step forward, you know, when America gets in trouble, that does trigger, I believe, good people stepping forward. And that's a good thing. Mm. And so hopefully that will be the case. But, you know, Republicans are usually the last to engage, I think, sometimes, because by our nature, we're independent. We're self-sufficient. We believe in those principles that you want to be left alone for the most part. And so oftentimes Republicans or conservatives are the last to get engaged. But when it comes down to it and you got so many things going wrong, good people tend to rise to the top. And hopefully that will be the case moving forward.
I agree with that. And Virginia is an interesting testing ground because it had been a red state for a long time and it trended blue. And bless Youngkin for stepping up because, I mean, that was not an easy mm-hmm. task by any stretch of the imagination. And it was interesting to listen to Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, who I know both of them very well, talk about this before the election and after the election. And they're both smart people, and they know what happened there.
Yeah, yeah. The administration acts like it doesn't know what happened.
Well, the administration may not.
The fact is, they may not. You know? Yeah. I mean, denial is more than a river.
A river, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. All right. Well, thanks, both of you. I have a couple other questions for the congressman, but Senator, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It was so generous with your time.
And again, I'm glad to be with Russ. We just love having him, and he's a pleasure to work with.
And we love having you in office. So, and thank you. Thank you, and also for people that come back there, thank you for embracing them. We'll be right back. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. We got a final segment here, a political day, if you will, with Congressman Russ Fulcher. I just wanted to kind of get your take individually on a couple of things here as well. Now, you all, just like, I know this, most of this action right now is happening in the Senate, right? Because is Manchin going to stick? Is he going to stay? And are we going to see some of the more moderates? But I am surprised at the Congress with the makeup. It has to be, I don't know, I'm going to make up a number, 35 or 40 seats that are in swing districts. And many of those were carried by Trump. And now we're going to go ahead and remake the country. These people are out. I mean, they just have to be out, especially after what we saw in Virginia. Is this going to affect the legislation coming forward that people are going to, or is the squad this powerful and important that they're gone anyway?
A couple of observations, Dave. First of all, the leadership or majority party, the Democrats right now, truly have problems internally because they've got this wing of the party that is totally committed to socialism and they don't even want to be called Democrats. They want to be called progressive socialists. And they are raising heck, and they're the ones who are really pushing the envelope for this social infrastructure bill, if you will. And they've converted the president, to be honest, mm-hmm. because he wasn't running on that when he came in. So that's one thing. But it's amazing to see when you get on that House floor how – at the end of the day, they do hold together. There is a tremendous amount of pressure and influence within that conference. And even though those swing districts know they are likely to take a beating at the election, at the polls, as a function of their vote to promote this socialism that America does not want,
mm-hmm.
They hang with their conference. They hang with their party at the end of the day. And I think in part, the margin is so close. There's only a few votes between Republicans and Democrats. And they know if they stray that could be the difference. Just either, even three of them. And that can be the difference on a particular vote. And so the influence and the pressure for them to hang together is incredibly influential. So that's how they have done it. And frankly, even though many of us saw an influence in a sign of how America feels with these most recent elections in Virginia and other places around the country, they are largely ignoring that. But to your earlier point about those swing districts, I think they know. And I think they know they're going to lose control in November of 22. And so for those progressive socialists, this is now or never for them.
Right.
And so they're going to do anything they can to push their agenda through.
They, I get, okay, and many of them are in totally Looney Tune districts, okay? They're safe. But the people are really, who never really were, who were more moderates, are willing to give up their seat next year to vote for that?
You know, what's happened already, if you look historically at the U.S. Congress, the turnover on the Republican side is much heavier than on the Democrat side. But already, I think there's at least a dozen members, and they tend to be those moderates in those swing districts who've said, you know what, we're not even going to run again. Because they know what's coming, and so rather than take a beating, they've just decided to step back. But and the other thing is that you know, a year in politics is an eternity, and so that's another reason why I think the Speaker wanted to get this vote in the rearview mirror as quickly as she could, is to let some time pass. So that, you know, a lot of people may forget. But, hey, you know what? Go to the gas pump. You're not forgetting. Go to the grocery store. You're not forgetting. And so, personally, I think it backfires. I think it backfires in a very big way. And we're going to find out November 22.
Do you think people are becoming more aware of the simplicity of saying that government does nothing well?
I do.
With the way we're having inflation, Afghanistan, anything you want to look at now. I know time can go by between now and 22, but it feels different than it did even a few months ago.
Therein lies the philosophical divide, I believe, Dave, between the current Republican profile and the current Democrat profile. The Republicans see private sector. They see individuals. They see families as the kind of that pinnacle of governance where the decisions really should be made. But the current makeup of the Democrat profile, especially with the socialist progressives, is government control, government control, government control. We have so many programs, so many regulations, so many rules that that takes the place of the family. It takes the place of the individual. It takes the place of the private sector. We've even got the president currently wanting to make private companies be the enforcement arm for vaccine mandates, for goodness sake. So that is the philosophical divide. Who should be in charge of this country? Should it be the individuals or the families, or should it be government? And that is what we wind up arguing over every single day back there.
Do they really feel that way? That the bureaucrats are so smart that they can run a country the size of America better than the individual thought of millions of people trying to provide the best for themselves and their communities?
Well, that's how they act, and frankly, I think it's to some extent self-serving, because if that's the case, then they remain in control. And that's a big motivating factor, you know. Yeah. And I'm not going to take, you know, personal shots at the Speaker, but let's face it, I have been around her a lot in the last 3 years. And Dave, she is addicted to the control. She is addicted to running the show, and it shows. And I think that's that motivation keeps them in power. They want to preserve that.
Congressman, I've got so much more. I hope we'll be back soon.
Love to do it. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Thank you. Have a great day. We'll be back next week.